Protecting what matters on The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL, 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. Brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
It's Tuesday, and it's Cinco de Mayo. Happy Cinco de Mayo. This is Barry Fisher, and this is Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore our current events, history, communities, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. We have two great guests today, and again, we're having some issues here with our first guest again. She tried a couple weeks ago and couldn't get into our phone lines, and looks like we're having the same issue here today. But hopefully we're going to get Megan Barth on the line here pretty quick. She's the executive editor of the California Globe. We're going to talk about a little bit about a big win for the Central Coast property owners against the California Coastal Commission. It was a big case that was just decided by the California Supreme Court in favor of property owners in the Central Coast. And then we're going to talk about more waste, fraud, and abuse as California burdens its citizens with more taxes and bad policy. And then, unfortunately, the dark cloud of socialism continues to descend upon California. In Los Angeles, one of the leading candidates for mayor is a democratic socialist akin to Zoran Mondavi of New York City. So, hang on. I think we got Megan here. Megan, welcome to Protecting What Matters.
Well, thank you so much. Good to be with you.
We finally got you through on the phone here. That's great. All right. I just kind of introduced you, but let me keep going here, and then I'll come back to you in a second, okay? Folks, okay. At 1 o'clock, we've got Lorelei Capel. She is the Atascadero Economic Development Manager. We're going to be talking about the Atascadero's impressive development renaissance over the last 5 years, how fiscal conservatism, lean government, and balance lead to success, and then past accomplishments and new projects that we can expect to see in the Atascadero area. You can call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So, Megan, we got you on the line, and I didn't have a chance to let you properly introduce yourself when you called it a couple of weeks ago because of our telephone issues. So tell us a little bit about your background in journalism. You're really busy, I can tell from all your writing.
I am very busy, and thank you very much for having me back on. I started in the press around 2009, and it, well, actually it was about 2007, 2008, and started covering the Obama administration, specifically Obamacare, became quite an activist, I guess, against Obamacare. So, you know, as a journalist, I do have an opinion, but my writing is relatively objective, meaning I try to provide both sides of the issue so my readers can make their own determination. And I also provide, you know, a lot of facts and a lot of data, because math doesn't lie, politicians lie. That's what I've always said. So, you know, math is definitely not my strong suit as a creative journalist, but I do tend to read a lot of data in this field and find it very helpful. I can break down data pretty succinctly and take complex, maybe litigation, and break it down simply. I've been kind of touted as that type of person. I've worked as an investigative reporter and did a lot of undercover work, especially during the pandemic, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I was, quote unquote, an essential employee, but no one asked me ever for proof that I was essential. So that kind of framed my opinion about the whole experience during the pandemic. But nonetheless, I love to investigate. I love to ask questions. I love to dig into data, dig into lawsuits, and then provide, you know, that knowledge to my readers so they can make an informed decision.
And you've had some really great interviews with President Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance. What were your thoughts? I mean, what was your takeaway from those interviews?
Well, I was actually called by the Trump campaign a couple years ago, and I was the first Nevada reporter that he interviewed with and that he spoke with. And so I was very honored that the campaign reached out to me directly. It was actually on July 3rd, and I was on the beach. I got this call, and I'm like, what's this number, you know? And so that was quite an honor, and I was able to sit down with him, I think it was in the following August, at the Trump Hotel in Las Vegas. And, you know, our 12-minute interview turned into a half an hour, and then he invited me to kind of follow him around for the rest of the day. And so I got a firsthand look and experience with the president of the United States, then campaigning for his second term, or third, if you will. But, you know, I was completely blown away, I guess, by his humility. You know, he doesn't really come off as humble on social media, but in person, he comes across as a very humble person. I've been around a lot of very powerful people in my profession, specifically politicians, and they have this air about them. And, you know, and maybe it's earned because, you know, I'm a member of the press and they tend to be very guarded. Donald Trump was not guarded at all. He was open. And many politicians want me to ask certain questions, and they'll give me the questions, and I always say, no, I'm not doing that, so find another reporter that will be your stenographer. That's not my job.
Right.
My job is to hold power to account. And the Trump campaign at the time did not ask for scripted questions. They didn't ask me what I was going to cover. It was completely off the cuff. The same with J.D. Vance. I had interviewed him at a rally that he had in Reno, and I was part of the press scrum, and, you know, they gave me about 10 minutes. There was a lot of press there. But again, very humble, very easy to talk to, very engaging, and was open, just open to whatever question I would ask. And that, as a reporter, is important to me. Like I said, I'm not a stenographer. I'm here to hold power to account and ask some tough questions.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting. The big question I have, and we probably don't have time to get into it today, but, you know, how he's going to get us out of this Iran situation, because it's really, I think, you know, holding back the prospects for the Republican Party in the next cycle, you know, this next midterm cycle. Very concerned about that.
And I don't disagree.
Yeah,
I don't disagree with you. I was just talking about that on a prior, just right before I got on with you. I was on another radio show out of Las Vegas. And I said, you know, he needs to wrap this up pretty quickly and get the Strait of Hormuz open. And, you know, he took a huge risk. President Trump, one of the first presidents in 47 years to take this type of risk. Instead of funding Iran like Obama did, instead of sending them pallets of cash, instead of trying to achieve peace through appeasement, which obviously was a massive failure for nearly 50 years. President Trump took the ultimate risk and is trying to achieve peace through strength. What I find very interesting, and was very surprised that the UAE got behind President Trump and his mission, whereby many of the countries in NATO did not, including Italy, including Germany, including England. That tells you all you need to know about NATO. So, you know, the appeasement era of, you know, the Obama administration, the Bush administration, and other administrations is obviously over. This risk that President Trump took, we're now in about, what, nearly 60 days of this conflict.
Yeah.
I was just driving around this weekend, and I live in Reno, and we have a gas tax, of course, state gas tax. And we are 90% reliant on oil from California. So even before the Iran war broke out, our gas prices were surging because your refineries were closing down. And we were well above $4 a gallon. Now we are above $5 a gallon. And I've even seen above $6 a gallon in more of the mountainous areas of Reno and Tahoe. So, you know, this is what people, if these gas prices remain inflated, these energy prices remain inflated, the GOP is going to have a very hard time this midterm. If we can get the Strait of Hormuz open and ships running and tankers running and getting oil to our shores, and opening up, of course, the pipelines here and becoming more energy independent. You know, if we can do that between now and the midterms, the GOP has a stronger chance of success.
Yeah, we're painfully aware. I mean, I paid, I think, $6.20 a gallon for regular somewhere the other day, and we have, I'm very pleased. I get Edward Ring to come on for about a quarterly to talk about who writes, of course, for the California Globe, and he talks about these this refinery situation all the time, that we've been, you know, cutting off our nose despite our face here in California for so long, and it's not getting any better. We have a you have a target rich environment here in California to investigate, so.
Well, yeah, you know, it's funny. I started working for the California Globe after the Nevada Globe, and I've worked with Katie Grimes for about 20 years. But I've only been covering California extensively since last August or September, and I could literally write a nonstop, never-ending investigative report on the fraud, corruption, and graft in California. But with that said, I was surprised to learn that back in the 1980s, prior to when I arrived in California, I didn't arrive in California until 96 and moved to Nevada in 2015, but you had over 40 refineries in California in the 1980s. Now you guys are under 10.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the last 30 years, you guys have been dominated by single-party control. Democrats have dominated, you know, your political sphere in all aspects of government, including the, you know, California Air Resources Board and all of these regulatory agencies that are basically accountable to no one. They have completely destroyed your refining capability. So you went from over 40 refineries in the 1980s to now less than 10. And, of course, your gas prices are going to go up if you're not refining the oil that you have in your backyard.
Yep, it's a big problem. I want to touch on a few of the articles you've written in the last few weeks, because one in particular has some local significance here, where the California Supreme Court reined in the Coastal Commission regarding private property here in the Central Coast. Do you have some comments on this one? I mean, this was really a big win for private property rights, wasn't it?
It really was, and I wrote about this as soon as the decision was handed down. There was a lawsuit that let me just grab it here because I want to make sure I'm. It was led by the
Pacific Legal.
Yes, thank you. The Pacific Legal Foundation, and it was a unanimous decision hailed as one of the most significant checks on the California Coastal Commission's power in nearly 40 years. The Supreme Court unanimously ruled that the agency unlawfully overrode a county-approved building permit for a home builder in San Luis Obispo County. That home builder was called Shear Development. The lawsuit was Shear Development versus California Coastal Commission, and the unanimous decision affirmed that the unelected California Coastal Commission can't simply second-guess local governments' interpretations for their own, you know, zoning programs or local coastal programs, nor can they invent new jurisdictional claims based on nine non-binding illustrations that are found in county plans. So the California Coastal Commission has been notorious to put politics before policy and politics before the law. And when the Supreme Court of California, which I have to assume is not conservative.
Good assumption.
When the Supreme Court of California comes down on the California Commission in a unanimous decision against them, it shows you just how out of touch the California Coastal Commission is.
Well, and again, I mean, one of the things that everybody talks about weekly here in this, everywhere in California, but particularly here in the Central Coast, is the need for affordable housing. And people just can't build anything anymore here because of the NIMBY kind of attitude that our local and state government has towards people who want to build a home. You know, that's not stack and pack. Stack and pack is great, but if you want to have a piece of land and build a house, it becomes a pricey challenge to get it done. So, yeah,
the cost of regulations are absurd.
Yep.
I mean, it adds tens of thousands of dollars to a single home, but when you're talking about a multi-family development, it's millions of dollars.
Right. Absolutely. And the big problem, you just published, I'm going to throw this one at you because you just published this morning regarding the Sacramento Democrats pass a bill to shield the high-speed rail failures from the public. Tell the listeners about this, because this is such a cabal of Democrat control in this state, and this is just a perfect example of what they're doing. Why don't you touch on this one here?
Oh, yeah, this one blew my mind. So I guess it's AB 1608 that
right.
was passed
yep.
by the Assembly Democrats. It was passed late last night. I caught a tweet about it and dug into it, and wouldn't you know it, you know, this whole high-speed rail project started as $33.5 billion. It is now estimated to go to $231 billion. That's a 700% increase, and yet you guys have no tracks to show for it. No trains running, no tracks. So instead of, like, looking into where all this money is going, where it's gone, why there are no tracks, why there are no trains, a Democrat assemblywoman by the name of Lori Wilson, who is in Sun City, if that's correct.
Yeah, Sweeson, yeah.
Sweeson City?
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah.
She authored a bill to create broad exemptions to withhold audit records.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
if we wanted to, as a journalist or as a person of the public in California like you or anybody else, wanted to get certain records about the spending, about the project, about the high-speed rail, you couldn't. Mm-hmm. Because now, those documents, many of them, will be protected by this bill.
Do we know how much money have they spent so far? Do we know that? And what have they spent it on? Is there any? Do you have any clue where this has gone so far?
You know, I wish I did. There is, you know, and also, oh, by the way, instead of going from... somewhere in the Central Coast, I believe, northern LA, all the way up to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Now the tracks have been cut in length, meaning you're not going to go to San Francisco anymore. You're going to go from, like, Merced to just a couple hundred miles north.
Yeah, Bakersfield to Merced or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so now that even though the costs have ballooned by 700%, the tracks have gotten shorter.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of creating a bill to create more transparency, because it's already under so much opaque, you know, language,
mm-hmm.
And there's not a lot available to the public, now Ms. Wilson, Assemblywoman Wilson, wants to hide all of that information. So I wish I did have some hard numbers on how much has already been spent. But it looks like over $100 million has already been, I'm talking in millions. This is billions.
Yes.
Billions. $231 billion. So we know at least $100 billion has already been spent, because now they need $231 billion.
Yeah. The last time I looked into this, I think a lot of the money has been spent on purchasing rights of ways and things like that, but nothing, no track has been built whatsoever. Hey, Megan, I'm going to put you on hold for just a minute through the break, and we'll be back. And I'd love to chat with you about what's going on in my hometown of Los Angeles with the mayor's race. It's getting pretty interesting. So stand by. And folks, we will be right back in about 2 minutes, so please stay with us. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Megan Barth, investigative reporter and executive editor of the California Globe. You can call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Well, so I'm a native of Los Angeles, Megan, and I spent some wonderful years there. I don't go there anymore. It's become such a hellhole. And now I'm watching the mayor's race, and I know you've done some writing about this and looking into this. You've got a failed Karen Bass who, you know, in most parlance would be considered a socialist. But then you've got a real Democratic socialist running against her who's surging in the polls. And then you've got, I don't even know who this guy is, Spencer Pratt, who's a Republican, whose house burned down in the Palisades fired. He's living in a trailer. and he's also in the mix. Can you unpack with us what's going on in L.A. and the mayor's race and what you think is going to happen?
Sure. Spencer Pratt has not declared that he's a Republican. He's actually been campaigning as an independent.
Okay.
And the mayoral race, which I understand is a nonpartisan office.
Yeah, I think so. I think it is. Yes.
Yeah, and so what I always do in nonpartisan races, including judges, is I always look at who's supporting them and where they're getting their money, and that will tell you exactly how they lean. Mm-hmm. But Nithya, and I don't know how to pronounce her last name, but she's running under the Democrat Socialist of America ticket. Karen Bass trained with the armed guerrillas down in Cuba with the communist regime. So I think we can pretty much safely say that she identifies as a Marxist or a communist or a socialist. They're all one and the same, basically. So you basically have two socialist Marxists running, and then you have Spencer Pratt, who is an independent. And he doesn't necessarily have these Republican ideas. He doesn't wade into the social issues. He's simply focused on the waste, abuse, and fraud in the L.A. area, and how, under their leadership, both Bass's and Nithya's leadership, how L.A. has literally spiraled downward into a homelessness haven filled with tents, filled with human feces, filled with crime, filled with fires. And as you said, he lost his home and his family lost his home in the Palisades. He grew up in the Palisades. Born and raised, and he has seen, especially after he started a family, just how dangerous the streets of L.A. has become. His message is resonating. He went from a reality TV star to an activist virtually overnight and has gained national recognition for his tenacity as well as his message. He has been producing low-cost social media commercials that are going viral, tens of millions of views. He is eliciting support from very wealthy, formerly Democrat donors who realize that perhaps voting the same way time and time again is the definition of insanity, especially when nothing is getting better. So he's got some legs under his campaign, and you can tell that he has legs under his campaign because of the reaction from Karen Bass and because of the reaction by Democrats. They initially thought that he was just kind of a nobody with no chance. Now he's actually gaining in the polls. When Karen Bass is only polling at 25%, that shows you there's a problem. And the problem is that the people who live and work in L.A. are tired of living in fear. They are tired of living amongst drugged out zombies as they're walking their children to school. They are tired of the potholes. They are tired. You know, I left LA because the more money I spent, the potholes got bigger. And I always thought my tax dollars were supposed to go to infrastructure. Obviously, my tax dollars were going to everything but infrastructure. And since 2015, that problem has compounded to the point where I don't recognize L.A. anymore, just like you.
Yeah.
So Spencer Pratt should not be discounted. He should be taken seriously, and he is being taken seriously by the incumbents.
Well, and in the meantime, you wrote on April 30th in the Globe that the L.A. City Council socialists are trying to make it so that non-citizens can have full voting rights in local elections, and they tried to do that. Didn't they try to do that in San Francisco too?
Yes, and it was struck down.
Was it? So, I mean, is this going to get some legs here in L.A. before the mayor's election, or is it just something that you think is not going to happen?
Well, you know, I never
try to never say never, huh?
I never say never because. Look, back in 2015, when I got the heck out of California, the other reason was because I opened up the Sacramento Bee, and the headline was, Bill stalls in Sacramento allowing illegal aliens the right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I closed my computer, and I said, you know what? They're not only taking away my money, they're taking away my voice now. My voice is going to be displaced by a non-citizen who should not have the right to, one, be here, and two, vote. So it's always been the Democratic plan to allow non-citizens to vote. And honestly, they can't tell us that they're not voting, because the only safeguard, which is a very weak safeguard, that Californians and Nevadans have is a simple box that says, are you a citizen, yes or no? If no, then you can't fill out this form. Well, if you're already dealing with somebody who lied to get into the country, do you really think they're going to be honest on a voter registration form?
Right. Absolutely. You know, we've got about 30 seconds left before we go to the break. Best way to follow you is at the California Globe, right? Is
that California Globe. CaliforniaGlobe.com, at California Globe on X.
And I just discovered you've got a whole thing where you'll email people weekly summaries of articles.
Yes.
And I just subscribed to that myself.
Real quickly,
anything you're working on that you can preview for us that we should be watching for? Any topics or stories?
Well, I just published one today about the Save America Act. It's specific to Nevada.
Okay.
California, I've got something in the hopper, but I'm not ready to talk about it yet.
Okay. Well, you know what? Well, that'll give me a good reason to get you back on. Megan, thank you so much for taking the time again, and say hi to Katie for me, okay? Thank you so much.
Will do.
All right.
Thank you.
Folks, we'll be back on the other side of the break after Paul Harvey and with Lorelei Capel, who is the Economic Development Director for Atascadero. So stand by. Back to Protecting What Matters. PWM is a broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products. It's easy for me to say today, to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, our history, community, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. And I have in studio a local treasure, Lorelei Capel, Atascadero Economic Development Manager. We're going to talk about Atascadero's impressive development renaissance over the last 5 or 6 years, how fiscal conservatism, lean government, and balance leads to success and past accomplishments, and what to look forward to in the future. Lorelei, welcome to your first visit to Protecting What Matters.
Thank you so much, Barry. I have never been called a treasure.
Thank you. A local treasure.
Yeah,
That's awesome. A local treasure.
I appreciate that.
Tell us, you are a local, and you know, you've been, we were talking before the before we went live about, you know, you've been at this economic development thing for quite some time. Tell us about your background.
Yeah, so homegrown here on the Central Coast, went to Cal Poly after Atascadero High School, go Greyhounds. And then after graduating with a degree in city and regional planning, I spent 20 or so years in private consulting, helping developers get through their processes and consulting to municipalities for downtown corridor revitalization and redevelopment, which is still a very big passion of mine when it comes to creating a sense of place in your downtown. And we're doing that here in Atascadero. So then found my way into economic development through a roundabout way when the announcement of the closure of Diablo came about. And that was fascinating, and joined forces with the Economic Vitality Corporation. Was there for 5 years until I decided the city of Atascadero was where my heart was.
So. Well, that's very cool. And how long have you been with Atascadero? 5 years? Now?
5 years as of Monday.
And they threw a tamale festival for you,
they
right?
They did, yes. This is our annual, and I had a great time.
Did you have a lot of people there?
We did. I heard we had like 18,000 people there.
Really?
Yeah, I would never have believed it if I hadn't already had my check-in with our events coordinator, Terry Banish, yesterday. But
that's pretty amazing.
It is, yeah. 5,000 tamales sold or something like that?
How many?
45,000 tamales.
That's a lot of, what's that called? Masa. That's a lot of masa.
That's a whole lot of masa.
All right. Let's talk economic development. The one thing I did my last minute research this morning, and it turns out, you know, I want you to start with what this thing, the 2045 general plan, and how that guides Atascadero and you and the city council in where you're taking, where you've come the last 5 years and then going forward over the next, I guess, 20 years, right?
Yes, exactly. So this is our blueprint as a city. Every city has one. It's just a matter of how recently have they updated it. So this was our turn. This vision for 2045 charts a path for us to understand where we're headed. So we've got a lighthouse, right? So we can't get off track with our decision-making as a council and staff following up on that. But it really helps us reverse engineer back to figure out how to really make things happen. And can they really happen? So it's an iterative process. It's a long process. We've been doing this for about 3.5 years. But it's a really amazing process because it will help us know as Atascadero, we will still be a city. Mm-hmm. We will have the vision and the character that we strive for, and that we will have everything to make our balanced budget. So how do you make sure that you have, it's like playing the game SimCity, right? Mm-hmm. You've got to make sure that you've got enough capacity in your wastewater treatment plant and that you have enough revenue coming in to pave your roads to keep your residents happy and keep the quality of life up. And that's what this is all about.
Yeah. So what I'm looking here, it looks like you have some key strategies here. The first one that's listed is, you know, expanding your economic base.
Yes. We have been a heavy bedroom community for a very long time. So housing rich, jobs poor, a little off balance, and that doesn't pay the bills in the long run. It's been great, and it's nice to know that we have a quaint community that's often quiet, but it's also, you need that business tax and revenue coming in to make sure the potholes are filled, make sure that the water comes, well, the wastewater has a place to go in the end, and just to make sure you're still attractive so we don't, you know, wilt and become a ghost town over time when the kids all decide to leave because there's nothing there for them. So that's really the idea, is why are people commuting over the hill? Why are they living in the Bay Area for 3 days a week? Why not Atascadero as a place to open their business? And this really does create the opportunities and allow for the zoning and the land use to be in line for those things to happen.
Okay. And one of the things that I think is really important here, and I can't remember where I saw it. I saw it somewhere in these notes that I printed out. But, you know, one of the things that health care is a huge need in this county, and I've talked to other guests about that before. What are you guys, you've really focused on bringing healthcare providers into Atascadero, haven't you?
That's true, yes. And we are actually trying to carve out space for that, so that it's you know, say Morrow Road, for example, has already leaning towards that heavy doctor kind of row, creating the space, making sure that everything that a brand new doctor, state-of-the-art doctor's office, dentist's office need is there for them, and making sure that there's like-minded companies so they know where that district really is. Atascadero is a hodgepodge. It was incorporated in 1979 and was remnants of whichever business went where. So we're trying to make method to the madness.
I don't know who figured out, who decided how to run the freeway through Atascadero, but they hopefully there's no monument to that city planner, is there?
You know what? I have not heard, but I have heard the stories of the discussion to go along the railroad tracks and along the river, or to go through town. And people said, well, gosh, wouldn't that be great? And this was a very long time ago, right? 50s, I believe. Why don't we have every off-ramp run straight to my business? Can you imagine the decision-making process that went on there? I wasn't privy to that. Wasn't alive yet. But I will say it was probably a difficult conversation, and it really divided our city into two halves, and created an 8-mile stretch of, you know, strip development that we're recovering from and building back from.
So what are the high level planning concepts that you and the city council utilize and focus as you start, you know, considering how you're going to attract businesses and how you're going to change the structure of the city so you can get the right businesses in?
Yeah, well, it really does start with exactly what you said, is kind of creating our jobs to housing balance, bringing back that ratio to make sure that we're not just a bedroom community and we are fiscally sound and sustainable for the long run. We're replacing aging infrastructure. I mean, right after this, I'm going straight to the groundbreaking for the new police station and fire station number 2, which without the power of our voters voting for Measure D20, we couldn't do. But those facilities are very old and not state-of-the-art, to say the least. And we need that dispatch center. We need the
safety. And where's that exactly?
So fire station number 2 is off of Santa Rosa, and our police station is right there off of Rosario at the north end of downtown. And that's just the first of the groundbreakings. We have a golden sledgehammer event June 8th for the fire station number one that's coming all the way down to the ground.
Okay.
And being rebuilt. Really honoring that it's been 70 years for that station, and it's time to make sure that our firefighters have everything they need to have an emergency operations center, clean room, no fumes coming in from their fire trucks while they're into the living quarters, all those things that need to be completely thought through and buttoned
up. Wow. What, you know, one of the things I talked to Paul Sloan about last week was how Paso Robles does it. We get a lot of feedback at KPRL in the Morning Exchange about, you know, people who've lived here for a long time and they don't like the development. Mm-hmm. How do you guys approach that in Atascadero? Are you getting much pushback from the old timers, or have you figured out a way to relieve that stress?
It's funny that you say that, because that happens at my Thanksgiving table all the time, just in my own house, right? Mm-hmm. Grandma says, roll up the drawbridge. You know, there's so many, and the change is relative to when you set eyes on it. So change for my kids is different than my change for my grandma. But I will tell you that we're very, very passionate and focused on preserving quality of life, which is also relative. I can say that the conversations have been very positive, and I'm very sensitive to that as someone who's homegrown, who wants to make my friends and my friends' parents and their grandparents really happy with where the city's going. You think, gosh, what happens when we get a Dutch Brothers, a Chipotle, and then a Chick-fil-A? Is it off with my head? I mean, I didn't order them necessarily, but I definitely negotiated with them when they were looking for the right place. I will tell you that there are more people that are more excited about it than are upset about the change, and they understand that if they don't invest and have new investment coming to Atascadero, then they're going to have to get on a plane to visit their kids in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And I think people understand the value of economic development. And just because we all got in and bought our homes at the right time, there are people that are our kids, you know, and our friends' kids that want to come back and have the opportunity and don't see the companies for them here on the Central Coast, that they either have to start them or we have to attract them.
Yeah.
So how do we make that go around so we don't turn into a ghost town?
Well, one of the big issues, and I was listening to Greg Haskin from CoLab.
Oh, yeah.
He lives in Atascadero, I think. But you know, he was talking yesterday on the weekly CoLab call about, you know, I don't want to mischaracterize what he said. I'll have him on in a couple of weeks. But, you know, that this whole thing, everybody talks about affordable housing, but nobody can really do anything about it. How are you guys approaching that whole affordable housing thing? I mean, Atascadero is a pretty narrow envelope of where you can build, isn't it?
Yeah, we have very few vacant sites that are just primed and ready for development that aren't constrained by geography or topography, for that matter. I think the biggest ticket has been the accessory dwelling unit, the ADU laws, and people coming in to say, gosh, you know, my kids might not be able to live here, or I got to take care of mom. What if I did put a second unit on my property? And the flexibility, and even our city's policy we created with four other cities in the region, stock plans for ADUs, where you can come in, just pass go, pay your permit fees, and they're already designed for you, and they've been plan checked. So it saves time and it saves money for the applicant. And that's a really great way to open up that, get rid of some of that pent-up demand. And for me, that gives me hope, because my 20 and 22-year-old might be able to stay for a while, pay off their student loans while they live off of us, and then maybe mom moves in to that ADU.
I mean, I have a real negative, what's the word I'm looking for, impression of stack and pack. I mean, I moved here because I bought a piece of property, again, it was 30 years ago now almost, and built a house, and I wanted to have some space to spread out. I mean, I don't see that really happening anymore around here, and that, which is kind of sad. We've got all this land, but then between the water constraints and the cost of infrastructure and all that, it's really hard to build like what we used to be used to, I guess.
Well, Atascadero has a unique situation because we're mostly on septic. And you can only go do so much with that before you foul your soil, right? And create some environmental hazards. So,
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, when the state of California comes up with really great ideas of how that should work in every city, it's not one size fits all.
Uh-huh.
For us, it's, well, are we on a one-way in, one-way out street that has a high fire severity zone, mm-hmm. where our firefighters are now doubling or tripling, you know, the number of people they need to save? Is there, you know, are they close to shallow groundwater, like mm-hmm. some of our areas? So we have some challenges, but I will say that when you will see density and change in the general plan that we're looking at, we are looking at till the 2045, adding another 6,000 residents. Mm. And that is consistent with the 1% growth rate that we've experienced. So it's not cold, it's not whiplash, right? Mm-hmm. It's measurable strategic growth. But you will find that what we're really looking at is intensifying any kind of density towards our commercial corridors near downtown, not in the areas where people have 5-acre, 2.5-acre
yeah.
lots. It's not really stacking and packing. It's what should we do with the properties that we do have left, and how can we make sure that those properties aren't upside down financially? And the answer to that is mixed use. If you have mm-hmm. a commercial component with some of the multifamily development, those actually pay for themselves mm-hmm. when it comes to police and fire and infrastructure. So
right.
it's a strategy to keep us fiscally sound, but it's a smart one.
Yeah. So what about, I mean, I see one of your bullet points here is fostering entrepreneurship. How are you guys doing that in Atascadero?
Ooh, I love this question. You know, my friends at, you know, County Office of Ed and Cal Poly, we always have joked that our region is a bunch of underemployed overachievers. You had people graduate with master's degrees that are architects during the day and bartenders by night, right? Mm-hmm. It's expensive to live here. Mm-hmm. You got to get really creative. You don't necessarily get paid Bay Area or Southern California wages. Why is that? Is it because we're stuck in the middle and, you know, there's just no demand and employers can pay what they want to? It is a problem. I know mm-hmm. that Reach has talked about that a little bit too,
yeah.
but we do have a challenge with that. I will say that, you know, we really do have an opportunity here to foster entrepreneurship, meaning wraparound support services for new businesses. We have a high location quotient for sole proprietorships on the Central Coast, mm-hmm. people who didn't find the company that they wanted to work for when they graduated Cal Poly, so they started their own. We have a ton of those people. I was an example of one of them who worked remotely for 15 years for a Bay Area company. Mm. It helped me afford my home on the Central Coast because I was getting paid Bay Area wages, mm-hmm. but living here. It also was exhausting because I was traveling with two young children all the time and when they were at home, but we figured it out. Now we have support services. Even the chamber has a workforce development component where they're helping companies find the right fit for if they want to expand and they mm-hmm. want to grow their employee base. We also have co-working spaces in Atascadero. We have mm-hmm. three, as a matter of fact, that are almost at capacity. They have a wait list, even some of them, mm. where you're not just working remotely at your home while your dog's barking and you don't have high-speed internet. You're coming into a social setting that is a great vibe. You have high-definition web conferencing available, a shared printer. The guy sitting next to you is a corporate attorney. You know, there's really great synergy that's mm. happening, and there's just around the coffee machine, which they actually have a very nice espresso machine at the Chambers co-working space that I frequent often. So alone, when those co-working spaces opened up, we had about 75 jobs in each one of people that may not have otherwise decided to locate in Atascadero. Mm-hmm. So entrepreneurship, that's a great way to start.
Well, and again, one of the things that came up again in my research is you guys have a really special relationship with your Chamber of Commerce, don't you?
Why don't
you talk a little bit about we got plenty of time here. We got about 3 minutes. Talk a little bit about that and how you've developed that.
Yeah, you know, I didn't start the fire. It was here before I got here 5 years ago at the city. But I will tell you, I didn't realize how unique that was because it seems very natural to us. There are things that government is well suited to do, and there are things that we are not, right?
Name three.
Yeah. We're here to help, right?
Yeah.
So
we're from the government. We're here to help.
That's when the doors slammed. No, I think truly people believe that because the city did something. They put their money where their mouth is, and they created this position, which is me, 5 years ago, because the council and the city manager said they really want to be business friendly, whatever that means, right? You really only know until your biggest challenge is in front of you, and you mm-hmm. see, did the city really help, or did they make this harder with policies? But I will tell you, as far as the chamber goes, they just got back from the Western Association of Chamber Executives, the WACE conference in Arizona, and apparently that's the biggest session, is how in the world can you get along with your city? How in the world? But our city has always seen them as a big partner in economic development for the things that we can't do. Mm-hmm. There are things we are just not naturally good at. It's as simple as supporting some of our local nonprofits. We at the city support all of our nonprofits, but we can't support all of them. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting when the chamber comes in and is able to lift them up, help, support, and be our proxy for those things too.
All right. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the great stuff that you've done and what you're planning in the next period of time, your next 5 years.
Yeah,
how's that? All right.
Great.
So folks, stand by. We'll be back. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Lorelei Capel, Economic Development Manager for the City of Atascadero. You can call in or text with questions, 805, or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So, Lorelei, here is a term that you don't often see these two words put together in the same line, lean government. How do you describe lean government, and how has that helped Atascadero with its economic development plans?
That's a great question. I'll start with the word lean. I'll start with just staffing. I think that we have been very cognizant as we grow as a community of now 30,000, making sure that our staffing ratios are keeping up, but are also not inflated. I mean, we didn't have a huge influx of dollars from tourism and wine, right, in the era. So we have, as a city of 30,000, about 100 employees or so, and compared to our sister city of Paso Robles in the North County, they have about 150. So they've got about 150% of our staffing for the same population.
Mm-hmm.
They have different challenges, more infrastructure to maintain, but we have more mileage, square mileage as a city.
Really?
It's a really interesting dynamic, but I will say that the people that we have, and I'm saying this as a resident first who came into government 5 years ago for the first time ever, wanting to see what it was all about, we have a lot of hustlers. We have a lot of people who do a lot of things at the city, and they really do it well, and they're really good people, and they're really motivated to get a lot done on a very thin budget.
Mm-hmm.
And we're used to working like that because we incorporated 100 years later than Paso Robles and 150 years later than San Luis Obispo. So they have a 100-year head start in the race to build your general fund, which pays for all of your salaries and your infrastructure improvements and things like that. So we have to be lean.
Yeah. I guess I wasn't around for that transition, but what must have been, Atascadero was what, before it was a city?
We were just unincorporated county.
Really? Okay.
And counties across the state, because I worked in several jurisdictions helping them incorporate, mm-hmm. helping them become cities before mm-hmm. I joined Nonprofit World of Economic Development, I will say that they can often become the dumping grounds for what is left and what uses the county doesn't really want to consider or spend a lot of time on.
Mm-hmm.
I think Atascadero did a pretty good job of keeping its own character and having its own downtown. But when you're unincorporated county, there's no council to decide mm-hmm. what's coming.
Yeah.
So you just get whatever it is. And whether that's a state hospital, mm-hmm. a light rail, you don't get a lot of say in that.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell us, let's look back the last 5 years. Give us some of the highlights of what you think has really been good and cool for Atascadero.
Okay, so I'm nerdy, so I'm going to nerd out on this one.
Okay.
And it's not as flashy as some people. Maybe you'll get into this with me.
Okay.
Broadband.
Okay, broadband, okay.
So it's underground. No one sees it. It's not that exciting to anyone but me. But this is what helps us stay competitive and stay state-of-the-art as a city. We created a broadband strategic plan. I think it's the first time we've ever gone with another city and co-managed a project. So your friend Paul Sloan, who was just mm-hmm. in here last week, and I co-managed a project. We submitted the grant application and hired the consultant. He got the grant money, and we were able to share very kindly a project that looked at the entire North County and developed a strategy for where we should go with our broadband fiber. Where are the missing pieces? Who's unserved and who's underserved? We had to do outreach campaigns to do self-speed tests to see who really was getting service and at how fast. What it really did was it called out some of our current and existing, providers and say, these people are not able to work remotely, even though you say they're getting 100 megabytes in speed. when you do a speed test, they're getting 20 and mm-hmm. they're paying for 100. What mm-hmm. are you going to do about that? So mm-hmm. it really held people accountable. It shook things up. And I think it kind of helped a little bit with the monopoly of, you know, how do we get there? In the end, it gave us some grant dollars to the tune of $6 million from the FAA.
We got a caller. Thanks for calling Protecting What Matters. What's your question for Lorelei?
Well, there were two different options I was looking at for basically stabilizing the economy with the high gas prices. One is making the bus system free, just totally free. That'll be so encourage people to get out of their cars that they're going to spend money on things that'll pay sales tax. And that sales tax will basically pay for the bus system.
Who's going to pay for that? There is no such thing as free.
Oh, sure there is.
No, who's paying for that? Who's going to pay for free bus? No, again, somebody has to pay for free bus care rides.
Well, I can give you an answer if you want it.
Sure.
I'm up in San Francisco. We had a member of our board of supervisors, Kevin Shelley. He was the son of the former Mayor Shelley, and he came up with the math on free muni up here. And basically, two-thirds of the bus system today, whether it's up here or down there, about two-thirds of it has to do with the accounting. You know, making sure nobody's embezzling.
Okay,
you know,
okay.
Making sure it gets-
Sir, the, you know, again, I don't need a deep dive into the muni. The taxpayers pay for this. People who have property. I want to go back to economic development in Atascadero, okay? So thanks for your call. Anyway. Stop laughing, Lorelei. Okay. So anyway, where were we? I think we've kind of knocked the idea of free buses off the list.
Hey,
here.
Maybe RTA and SLOCOG need to get together and
maybe
have a conversation with our friend. But mm-hmm. you know, it will come from our pockets, most likely.
Well, again, I mean, this is the whole concept of, you know, if somebody thinks something is free, it's not. And that's basic economics. So we have another caller or the same caller. Let's find out. Whoops. Hello? Damn phones. Okay.
So I think we're talking about successes.
Yes. Talk about successes.
As a result of our broadband strategic plan, we were able to find new partners mm-hmm. that came to the table that were not existing before and said, hey, you have a problem. I'm happy to fill this gap out to these areas that are unreached and unserved or underserved. And we'd like to apply for some private grant dollars, and they're installing 10G fiber around our community, so I'm excited about that.
Hang, I want to ask you about this in a second. Thanks for calling Protecting What Matters. What's your question?
In 1776, we were trapped as colonies. The money was sucked out of town. That's what's happening with the oil companies. Making it free, make sure the money stays
Thank
in
you.
Town.
Thanks for calling Protecting What Matters. Do you have a question for Lorelei?
Yeah. She was just talking about their internet
mm-hmm.
for the city of Tusker.
Yeah.
Is that free?
No, it's not free, is it?
No, but...
Well, where does the grant money come from?
The grant money came from our taxpayer dollars to the federal government through the state.
All right. So why should the city or the county be providing internet service?
We're not. We actually partnered with providers, local providers, and the...
I think it was just to put the infrastructure in, correct?
The infrastructure in the ground.
Yeah.
And now we have the ability to run 10G fiber, to switch on 10G fiber, and it'll be coming to the home. So it'll be offset by the fact that private subscribers will come in and say, I would like, you know, fiber at a cheaper rate than I'm getting now with higher speeds. And it allows some of our pretty archaic, like coax cable and copper under the ground to be upgraded to true high-speed broadband internet fiber, which is glass fibers. Mm-hmm. So it keeps us competitive.
That's all a bunch of way over my head. But you're not competing with the other private entities?
Well, no, it's not
providing
internet. We wouldn't. We created the plan and the strategy, and then called for partners that would be willing to partner with us, and then allowed them to use while we were doing other projects. For example, like our downtown infrastructure project. You know, a call for people that when we open up the street to put in their conduit, run fiber if they like. So it really is creating more competition and having higher results. And it attracted those grant dollars that, yes, they were our tax money at tax dollars at some point, but they funneled through the federal government back to the state, and here they are back in Atascadero. So.
Yeah, a lot of this comes from federal grants for rural, you know, it goes back to the old rural electrification grants from the 1930s and that kind of stuff. So, but yeah, but I mean, ultimately, the broadband is still provided by whoever's doing it, right? Verizon or whoever, something like that. Thanks for your call. Well, but that kind of leads me to another question. Is this broadband infrastructure being made obsolete by Starlink?
Starlink's a great option, actually. I think it. A lot of our neighbors did it because they were so impatient. They couldn't wait for this.
Yeah.
And so a lot of our neighbors are on Starlink and they're happy with it. But we do know that the most stable way you can provide internet services under the ground, weatherproof, stormproof.
Yeah, well, I know that's what I use at my ranch, but and I used ranch Wi-Fi before that, you know.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I mean, you have to have high speed internet today to be able to do business anywhere. Really.
Yeah, I have experience just working remotely from home when couldn't get Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi was down, having to run to a Starbucks to try and upload your grant your proposals. So it's challenging for those here, and now the demand's even higher. For streaming online or online doctor's appointments, learning, remote learning. So we've got to serve everybody. And really, we don't serve anybody because we're government. We open it up and made the competition a little bit more fierce. And people, it's pushing prices down.
Good.
And it's catalyzing more infrastructure.
Well, yeah, Starlink is not inexpensive if you want the full pipe.
We want redundancy, too.
Yeah.
When one goes down, you want the other. Our neighbors on the other side of the cul-de-sac have one service and we have the other. Our kids were running back and forth between houses during COVID because somebody would have an outage. It was actually a really great case in like why we want a diversified, redundant system for, you know, especially when it's your EOC, right? Or Diablo Canyon.
Right.
Or Vandenberg. We want them to have redundant fiber.
Yeah, and again, I mean, it's going to be a big deal for the spaceport if they get the spaceport here as well. So let's talk about something less geeky than broadband. What other successes like? Other than the Tamale Festival, which is absolutely the other side of the geek quadrant. But anything else that you'd like to kind of highlight that you've done here over the last few years?
Well, just some funny stories. My first day on the job, first week on the job, I'll say, a friend of mine, this is how it works in North County, is like, hey, you should call my friend Greg King. He owns, you know, Valley Fresh Market. Mm-hmm. And I worked with him at Vons forever. He's great. You know, hey, Greg, my name's Lorelei. My friend Mike told me I should give you a call. I heard you're thinking about making a move to North County. Oh, yeah, I'd love that. You know, what are you looking for? I'd like something with freeway frontage and easy on, easy off. And, well, you know, we got a couple options for you. You know, there's a Kmart Center that's ready to be redeveloped. And we also have Clint Pierce at Midon Enterprises building something off of Del Rio. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow, can I get his number? I just saw the email when I was cleaning out some inboxes, and it felt like my first dollar earned, right? It was the very first day that this connection was just fruitful, and there they go. So they opened up, you know.
That's a great market.
6 months ago, they're actually doing very well now that they got their prices back in line with Central Coast prices instead of Ojai prices. But they fell on their sword on that one and said, we're dialing it back. We're doing our best. So that's just one example. Other than that, I've attracted a number of other businesses, including a child care center, which is imperative for if you want to be a working family, right?
And you got some other stuff going into that next to Valley Fresh. Yeah. What else you got going in over there?
Yeah. So the Central Coast Distillery just opened up this month.
I'll be there.
They're wonderful.
Are they open now?
They are. And on Fridays they have prime ribs. So you got to hit that up. Two doors down will be Anna and Company, a really great retailer that was downtown who expanded and tripled her size, I believe. A child care, like I just mentioned, will be going in there. That is the learning experience. They're on one of the pads that is just about to break ground. And a couple other small manufacturing businesses that are going that I don't think they've announced who the leases are, but exactly what we were hoping to attract for a job center with roll-up doors, a couple thousand square feet. You can bang on things. You can...
So mixed use.
Yes, vertical mixed use. It's, and residents, two floors of residence above.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's very cool.
Right now.
That's very cool.
It is.
All right. What about... tell me a little bit about... You know what? What caught my interest here... was I didn't realize that the Carlton has been bought by Marriott. Isn't it?
It actually wasn't purchased by Marriott. It was purchased by a family, Capricorn Properties.
Okay.
And they decided to enter into the Marriott franchise.
Okay.
And they had to jump through a lot of hoops and get that permission to become a Marriott Tribute property. So that is the same level of customization as the Hotel Cerro downtown SLO.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really, they have to serve, you know, meals per day and have
it's such a nice and beautiful
rooms.
Building.
Yeah. And so they also figured out what wasn't working, which is the 10,000 square foot restaurant on the ground floor, right?
Mm-hmm.
That never could quite make it through each generation. So now they've brought it down to 4,500 square feet.
Okay.
And they're opening Mabel Lounge this week or next week. And it'll be cocktails and light bites and for their patrons that are staying in the hotel. And they're also their the community. So that's another place we'll have to go after we go to the distillery.
Yeah. Well, we do an El Camino crawl. What about, you know, how is that new parking situation working out? I mean, I find it kind of a little annoying.
Yeah, a lot of people were nervous about it. They were like, how are you going to back out when mm-hmm. people are going 45 miles an hour? And I will say, having worked in about 75 downtowns in the western U.S., it's a great strategy for bringing the speeds down, especially when you have two schools straddling what was our highway, El Camino, right? Five lanes.
Right.
People are actually driving less than 20 miles an hour. And if you want to cruise a little faster, you probably want to stay on 101 or you want to just go over to Palma. You've got a couple routes through. But if mm-hmm. you want to cruise the strip old school style and
yeah.
kind of chill on a Friday night, people love walking, driving down it. The lights are on. People are walking around now. It's changed our complete vibe, and it's brought us back to the Americana city that I think we were before we were. Our highway was bypassed by a highway, right? Mm-hmm. So it brought the purpose back to our people, and I think it's reinstated a little bit of pride. People were a little nervous, but I just had to remind them, you've been backing out into traffic on East Mall for the last 20 years mm-hmm. without any problems, because guess what? You stop at that stop sign, you slow down. It's not a racetrack. You're
yeah.
not going 40 miles an hour anymore.
Yeah, no.
And we haven't had any problems. I mean, other than maybe someone hitting a curb or something, because we've got some new bulb outs. You know, it's a learning curve, but the kids are all safer. And I think it's created a little bit of a vibe. And it's what it's really done is attracted some private investment, because people saw that dollars, again, grant dollars. Yes, they were our tax dollars at one time. Federal grant dollars came to our city, back to our city,
mm-hmm.
and have really renovated it.
So. It's kind of created kind of a mall kind of atmosphere.
Yeah.
Outdoor mall. But
it has, yeah. And there's lights on at night, and people are walking around. It's not a ghost town after five anymore. And I will say, growing up here, that's exactly what it was.
Really?
Yeah.
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 So, okay. What else? I mean, you got something going on. You got some housing projects going on, it looks
we
like.
We do, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that. We got about another 2 minutes here, three
sure.
minutes.
Okay, so I'll start with Del Rio or Emerald Ridge. There's some projects up by Del Rio that you'll see. You saw a really beautiful high-end apartment complex mm-hmm. going in. Well, there's phase two of that. So there's okay. going to be even more housing, workforce housing. They're really beautiful. And they have actually been completely leased out since the day that the other.
So they're opened. Rentals.
They are rentals, and they're going. That's built by Peter Laughlin, and they're going. It's going famously well. So
good.
We'll get those done soon. We've got a couple other projects, but a lot of what you mentioned, we still have quite a few of those single family residential homes. We saw Las Lomas be developed at the south end of town. Now we have, you know, the Morescos are building something beautiful, kind of out on Eagle Ranch, mm-hmm. just some custom like five homes at a time. So we do have a lot of that very Atascadero character build going on. But you've got projects like the La Plaza project downtown. That is the restaurants on the ground floor and stories.
Okay.
That model
That's where
is
Cielo
working.
Is?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It's working. And people are looking at the remaining pieces of the downtown puzzle like that.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the Bank of America property. We've got Huckleberry's property right downtown. And people are coming up with concepts that are very similar to that that will work in this day and age and economic situation.
Yeah, and what are you doing to, I mean, promote Atascadero? I mean, what kind of, you know, outreach you doing to get people, you know, because again, obviously, Paso Robles has a heavy tourist mm-hmm. industry. Are you trying to do the same for Atascadero?
We are, and the way that that's happening is very curated and intentional. Terry Banish is our events mm-hmm. coordinator and PIO and unicorn. She does all the things. But she really has been creating events that are specific for our people and our neighbors. So mm-hmm. great if you are, you know, we don't do Zinfandel Fest 2026, right? We do the Tamale Festival because we have 21 Mexican restaurants and they come out in drones and they sell a heck of a lot of tamales, right? But it's also our fall festival. That's for our people. That's like the Mid-State Fair without the animal smell, right? It's awesome. It's rides. They basically take over downtown and it's this really great old country fair kind of feeling with Ferris wheels in front of our city hall. It's beautiful.
Well, we're getting the hook here for the next couple of minutes, but when we come back, I want to wrap up some of the other new things you got coming into town and what we can look forward to in the coming year. So, yeah. Folks, stand by. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Lorelei Capel, Atascadero Economic Development Manager. You can call in or text with questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Next week's show, I have a very interesting young man. His name is Ryan Rundell. He is the TPUSA and Cal Poly Young Republicans presidents. And they are actually trying to get Chad Bianco and Steve Hilton and a couple of the other Democrat candidates to come and speak at Cal Poly. So we'll get an update on that. And then my old friend from the think tank world, Steve Moses, he's a senior fellow at Paragon Health. And we're going to be talking about all the waste and fraud and the in-home support services that we've been hearing about in California and Minnesota. And we have another caller. You got to turn down your radio, please. Thanks for calling Protecting What Matters.
Yes, I was wondering, is it appropriate to ask what's planned for the former Kmart shopping
center?
That was
our next topic. Are you reading our minds?
Great segue. Wow.
Okay, thank you. You know what? Why don't you just come and host the show, okay? That was my next question.
Yeah.
Oh, well, it's very coincidental, isn't it? I'll listen to your answer off the air.
Okay, thanks so much.
It's a great question. That's actually the number one question I get. I was just telling Barry that. I will tell you that the owner of the property, who's owned it for about 4 years, has now assembled that corner parcel that has never been built. So now they own everything on there. It used to be held for in a different property owner. But they have spoken very openly about taking the Kmart building and divvying it up into three spaces. So maybe 25, 25. It's a 70,000 square foot space. So you can do the math. But they were hoping for something along the lines of a Tractor Supply and a Ross and a grocer. I will tell you that we have a lot of grocery stores and we might be overgrocered. But I will also say that the latest idea, they talked about coming in and maybe raising the whole site and renovating and coming in with a whole new plan, because our new general plan and zoning code will allow for different uses. All they need to do is come in for a use permit and say, this is what we're thinking, and we would entertain it. But it will hold that commercial use still, because we need that as a city to bring in that revenue.
Yeah.
But residential included isn't a bad idea. Maybe some roll-up door spaces and some really great places for some of our businesses that need more space.
Yeah.
Not a bad idea.
So. Well, and you were saying, I mean, you know, Atascadero is really getting kind of a younger vibe to it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we just noticed a really great influx of folks probably who were from San Luis that just knew they wouldn't be able to buy a home. They have a growing family. They like the quality of life. They moved here maybe a little bit begrudgingly and said, well, gosh, I'm here. I wanted a little more space for my kids. I love this. I'm finding the people that I resonate with, my kids, the quality of life, the schools. I mean, it's a really great existence. I'm a little biased because I grew up here. And I also brought my kids, you know, raised my family back here after I left for a while. But it is. It's what's happening is really special. It's funky. It's not completely gentrified. Atascadero has a lot of really awesome salt of the earth people doing cool stuff. They make things, they're makers, they're brewers, they're all these great people. And it is young and they are working professionals. So I think we've got a lot of life and vibrancy, which is adding to the vibe and what's really desirable about Atascadero. Plus it's a tree studded community where you don't really see your neighbors, even if you are in like a subdivision per se.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the last minute or two we have left here.
Yeah.
In your, you know, economic development manager's eyes, where do you see Atascadero being 5 years from now? What's it going to look like? How many more people will be living there? And what are some of the challenges you're going to be facing?
You know, our population will probably only grow about 1% a year. I will say we'll probably be at, you know, 31,000, 32,000. But I would say that the remaining vacant properties that we have in Atascadero that are large sites, there will be development interest, and some of those will have been completed. We have great projects in the pipeline, like Barrel Creek, which is across from the Del Rio interchange. And that is like a Tin City modeled sort of project with some residential at the front. So it kind of mirrors what's happening at Colony of Apple Valley. But I do see a lot of our final properties, including the Dove Creek commercial piece all the way at the south end of town. Those will have broken ground and be built. And you'll start to see what is our grown up self as a city, as a young city. You will start to see us growing up, not necessarily vertically, but definitely filling in the last few pieces of our puzzle. And it's going to be beautiful. It really will be.
What will the big challenges be?
Infrastructure.
Yeah.
I mean, they created a freeway system that doesn't allow for the volumes at a lot of our intersections. You'll notice that it in and out on an occasion, getting across San Anselmo. But, you know, when Caltrans is ready to start looking at our area for upgrades and we bring our own money to the table, we'll be able to kind of come up with some of those challenges. In the meantime, we're just working on our police and fire stations and a wastewater treatment plant so we can keep up with our growth.
Yeah, what's with the wastewater treatment plant? Is that going to solve some of the sewage issues once it gets finished?
Yeah, we're almost at capacity. So we have a master plan process underway right now. We have a great, we have a great reputation for being a city that knows how to balance our budget and is good to our words. So we will get some great bond ratings, and that's great for our taxpayers. So
yeah,
we're going to be looking at financing that. And of course, the regulations become more stringent every year from the state. So mm-hmm. we've got to meet their needs, and then we're good to go. So,
all right. Well, yeah. Lorelei, thanks for coming in.
Thank you. And
thanks for not wanting to have free buses on El Camino Real.
But, we all want free buses.
We just don't know
where the money is.
There you go. All right, folks. I'll be back. Thank you for being in, and it was great, great, and very informative. Folks, I'll be back next week with Ryan Riddell and Steve Moses, and I'll look forward to talking to you. Have a great week.